Okay, so, okay. We're ready.
If Randy's back now, I'm supposed to go test somewhere else.
Okay.
I may have to vice chair.
Okay, that's fine.
You're ready.
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay. House Water and Environment Committee will come to order. We will open as a subcommittee this morning until our sleepy colleagues show up. And I'm gonna open a public hearing on House Bill 3099. We have the Honorable Representative Leonard here this morning. Welcome to this meeting. And I will read the summary because Megan is just getting it. This directs the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to create system for renewing of hunting and fishing licenses by mail. Specifies the system should be in place by July 1st, 2003. Sounds like a great idea.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. My name is Randy Leonard. I'm a state representative from Southport. And that's all it is. It's an idea. I sat on the salmon, well, I'm not going to try to say SR2 committee last session, in addition to this session, and along with Representative Morgan. And we heard testimony at that time from ODF&W that their license renewals were dropping. I understand that might be turning around now. But I remember sitting and listening to the testimony and thinking that the ability to renew your license just as a person is about as difficult as it can be. In terms of if you are a person that likes to fish as I do, but never had the time to fish as I don't, when that opportunity arises, you know, and I live in an area where we do have some opportunities to fish, when that opportunity arises, I realize that I have to go out to the Gresham G.I. Joe's, get my license, and then go. And it's just enough of a hindrance that I don't go. I was at the coast this weekend. And we have 2 acres down at Sand Lake. The tide was high. I have poles there. I had forgotten to renew my license. Just even knowing this bill was coming up, I'd forgotten, so I didn't have tackle and everything, so I couldn't go fishing. So my thought was, if you could renew a license as easily as you renew the registration on your vehicle, your boat, your RV, which is a notification that comes in the mail. I would be a person, and I've talked in the last 2 years to a number of people who feel the same way. I would be a person that would gladly renew my license by mail every year, whether I had any plans to fish or not, just so I had it for the convenience of having it. And I suspect there are a lot of people in this busy world we live in that are a lot like I am that would look back in a prior year, and if you had fished, it really wouldn't make any difference whether you renewed it or not. You just know that you have it for the convenience of being able to go fishing. And so it was just a thought I threw out in the form of a bill that I think could really help ODF&W. Obviously, it's going to change the way they do business, and I don't think that's a bad idea either. I think marketing for state agencies, particularly ODF&W, should be as important as it is in the private sector. And I know if, for an example, my wife reminded me of belonging to a health club. We pay dues and don't always use it, but we kind of feel good that we pay the dues and know that if we want to use it, it's available to go use it. And if we ever quit paying, you know, decide to drop out, then we are just pestered to death by the club to renew, and they do everything in their power to make it as easy for us as possible to renew. But I think this idea of possibly being able to get a license over the internet, I know I've purchased tickets to events over the internet, the Seattle Boat Show. Every year I buy the ticket for it right over the internet, and I print the ticket out on my printer at home. Anything, I think, to make it more convenient for Oregon residents to get a license would help ODF&W not only keep its customers, but I actually believe dramatically expand the number of customers that get pay the license fee every year. So that's it. Thank you.
Representative Leonard, the idea would be that probably by mailing out the notices, that they would more than make back the money that it would take them in postage. Is that your feeling?
That is exactly my feeling, that they would more than make that up. ODF&W, I think, is going to be saying something here this morning. I believe they're here. They think that it's going to be very expensive. They've suggested possibly a pilot project, which I think is a great idea. This is just an idea, I think, that should stimulate some thinking about marketing. And it shouldn't be just confined to this idea. Like I said, it should be, we should think about having the opportunity for customers to go online and buy a license. I don't know what impact that would be. But what we should be thinking more about making the system more customer-friendly, and it is anything but that now.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Leonard, you mentioned Internet also, but you're thinking of that as a separate option after this pilot would be tried, so...
Or it could actually be done concurrently. I guess it's, you know, and I'm sure most of you agree with me, that I understand government provides particular services and they're here for a particular reason, but I do believe in the concept of state agencies trying as much as possible to reach out to customers as do private businesses do, and I think there's something to be learned and gained from that in this example.
I really agree with you because I know I would renew mine every year even though I wouldn't necessarily use it just if it was easy to do.
Mm-hmm. I think, Randy, that one of the things that we're all real clear on in the workings that we've had with ODFW is that we're real anxious to try to open up ways for to facilitate the communication. I'm not even awake yet. Between the agency and its customers. And that this, I think, is one of the places that has real potential to do that. That, you know, I'm coming from a small town, it's not a big deal to pop down to the local hardware store and get a license on their computer system. And it's not a big deal to pop into Fred Meyer's in Roseburg. And it's real convenient that they're open late hours and, you know, for people like me that always forget to get their one-time license, I can kind of bail myself out of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But to explore ways to do it on the net and to have people hook into the existing computer system through the net and print their licenses out is a real good thing to do. And I think also exploring, you know, whether there maybe could be a checkoff box when you get your initial license that you want to be notified by mail.
Mm-hmm.
That there are some things that we should be looking at here. We need to be real mindful of the fiscal impacts this time around because basically we've got an agency that's going to be going through some pretty heavy transitions here. But I think that it is something that should definitely be looked at, and the idea of a pilot project to test out how much response there is to this and being real mindful of, you know, sucking money out of the system that is going in other directions right now. But I think you've got a good idea.
Thank you. And again, I didn't get out of here quick enough. I can see that. it wasn't my thought to say this is a solution for the agency in terms of increasing their revenues. It struck me as something that could benefit the customer and the agency because I believe that, and this is just a subjective belief based on my own behaviors, but I just believe that whatever it would cost would be more than made up in revenues by renewals eventually. And understanding at first it's going to...
We've just been handed a fiscal on this one that is kind of shocking. As fiscals are often wont to be. But, you know, and I think that what this does is just kind of give us one of the sideboards on the concept for the program that we obviously can't afford right now, but that doesn't mean that we can't afford some other form of this in a different kind of a way.
Right.
And I think you've laid a real interesting idea on the table.
Great, thanks.
Any other comments, questions? They're all in shock.
No, Madam Chair.
I tend to think, have they tried this in other states? Have they, if we could get some information from other states that maybe have done this to show the difference of what it was maybe before they implemented it and after, because I'm in the same boat. I don't renew I would through the mail, but I don't take the time.
Or the internet, maybe, would you do it?
Or the internet.
Well, Representative, we have Kay Brown from the agency next up on the testimony list too, so she might be able to answer some of those questions that you have.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Leonard. Kay Brown from ODF&W.
Madam Vice Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Kay Brown from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I want you to know that I wholeheartedly support Representative Leonard's concept. It's what I've been suggesting for a long time. And like many of you, I too, if I were mailed an application form in the mail, more likely would buy a license than if I had to go out on my own. And certainly the department's very interested in implementing any kind of system that would be helpful to our customers. Last year, we sold about 844,000 licenses. That includes about 70,000 prepaid daily licenses. And developing a renewal by mail system would require manual processing and create a large workload because of the large numbers of licenses you're talking about. I wanted this system to work too, and I asked our people to run the numbers in every way they could think of to come up with something that was workable. And every time we ran them, we got the numbers like what you saw on the fiscal impact. They're very large because of the large numbers of license renewals that we have. And a suggestion might be to develop some sort of a small pilot program and see if there were some more efficiencies that we might be able to develop in creating a system. One thought that we had might be to wait until a large number of people had already renewed their licenses like they do at the first of the year and then send out renewals, so you didn't have that very large number of people that we were looking at. But those are all issues that we would need to explore in more detail. I've presented you with a copy of my testimony, and attached to that are a lot more details on the numbers, because I was pretty shocked at those high numbers too. We're talking at $900,000. And yet we're suggesting that offsetting revenues would only be in the neighborhood of $200,000 or so. One suggestion I had was, or asked them to look at, was what would happen if you eliminated our point-of-sale system entirely and just went to a renewal system like the Department of Motor Vehicles. Those numbers don't work out either, and you'll see the details of that in my testimony as well.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you at any point considering contacting a private sector mail house and see what it would cost them to do this?
Representative Cruz, we didn't go into that level of detail, but I think you'll find that those numbers would still be quite large. We might be able to reduce those mailing costs to some extent.
I guess, Madam Chair, the reason for the question is there are organizations that do this sort of thing, do it rather efficiently and make money, and my sense is that if we're going to have this discussion, it might be prudent to find out what it would cost to outsource this.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Representative Lee.
Thank you. If we were going to outsource it, it would be good to look at one of the entities like the Garten Foundation, who would do it at even a less expensive rate and also help people.
Madam Chair, the same question I had to Representative Leonard. Do you know of other states that have a system, or have we looked at what other states have regarding renewal by mail?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we haven't polled all the other states to look at what they have. What we do know is that we have the point of sale system, which we believe is one of the state of the art systems that probably is the least expensive in terms of renewals of other states. But in terms of what other states are doing for renewals, no, we did not look at that.
Representative Half.
Thank you. Can you buy licenses for 5 years at a time?
Madam Chair, Representative Hask, no, that's not an option currently.
I'm just wondering if the idea here is to give, you know, people a chance that they have to go to G.I. Joe's every year, maybe on a sliding scale, buy for 2 years or 3 years, 10 years, lifetime.
Madam Chair, Representative Hask, we've not, the legislature has not implemented those kinds of systems. They have been an annual license as long as I can remember.
Further questions? I missed your testimony. I just had a couple of questions. Are the licenses only available at G.I. Joe's?
Chair Close, we have about 600 license agents scattered around the state that have the point-of-sale systems in their stores. In addition, we have them available at all of our regional offices as well.
So would it be correct to say that after hours, whatever the hours of those stores are, then people can't buy the license? Is that true?
That's correct. Hey, Representative Morgan?
I think the point should be made, too, that the computer system that generates licenses has kind of gone through some growing pains over the years, but it is getting better and better, and I think that the number of complaints that are being received about the system have been dropping off. This is the one where people were very concerned about having to use their social security numbers, and that has been pretty much taken care of. So whenever I've used the system, I found it to be really convenient and really responsive. And, you know, just the thought that you can go into Fred Meyer's at 10 o'clock at night and get a fishing license is a huge level of convenience.
If there's a Fred Meyer in your town. You heard Representative Leonard say that he would be interested in the pilot program. Is that, since I wasn't here, maybe you said this, but did you address that?
Chair Close, yes, we certainly would be interested in looking at something like that, too. We think that there's merit. There's certainly some customer service benefits for renewing by mail. It also gives us an opportunity to mail out information in the renewal applications that we might not otherwise be able to do, and certainly we would be able to tap into a number of people who wouldn't normally purchase licenses except for if someone, you know, overtly ask them to do that by sending them a license renewal. So there certainly would be some revenue benefits in renewing. So we could come up with a system that was revenue neutral or generated revenue. We'd be very willing to take a look at that sort of thing.
So how would a pilot work? Would you do several counties? Would you just do it for 2 years, the whole state? How would you see that being set up?
Representative Close, I'm sure we would not try to do the whole state at once. We'd try to do a smaller one. One of the things that I suggested would be to look at maybe sending out renewals after a certain period. Say you got your first 6 months of renewals from people who normally would renew anyway, and then take a look at those people who had not renewed and send out renewal notices to them. That would be a large cost saving in terms of the having to mail out renewals to everybody who purchased a license. So that would be one thing that we might be looking at.
Would you be willing to work with Representative Leonard on an amendment?
I'd be most happy to.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much. Call Phil Donovan, Northwest Sports Fishing Industry.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. That association represents G.I. Joe's, Fred Meyer's, Fisherman's Marine Supply, as well as a number of mom-and-pop bait and tackle stores that are located around the state. And when this legislation was introduced, I put out a memo to the association basically inquiring about the impact of the revenue of the point-of-sale systems that all these stores maintain. And what was returned back to me was that we don't care how licenses are sold just as long as we are selling licenses. Right now, anytime you purchase a license from G.I. Joe's, you pay $1.50 surcharge. The retailers estimate that in terms of having brought that system into the store, having invested their employees' time into managing the system itself and then the customer service, they probably aren't making money on the system. You know, the surcharge, it probably breaks them about even. Some even think it costs them money. But it's important to them to have it there for the conveniences that you were talking about, Representative Morgan. So with that, I just wanted to come in and point out that, you know, we're not concerned about the revenue hit, because we think that if you do go to this program, there might be fewer licenses and tags that are actually sold in the stores. That's a little concern. We want to see as many licenses and tags sold. Those folks will get into the stores when they need the retail services that they provide. And this was just meant as a service to the anglers and the hunters. And the ideas that were mentioned about a pilot program were ideas that we've kicked around internally as well, because for myself, having managed political campaigns, I know how much mailings can cost. It's, you know, it's very expensive. But nonetheless, if you were to do a pilot program like right now, you've got spring Chinook season that attracts a lot of anglers. Sunday's Oregonian, you know, River of Plenty. And there's a lot of good press that's out there. And if ODF&W was doing a renewal notice right now, you've gotten, you know, the hardcore folks who are going to buy a license come hell or high water. So the other idea, of course, would be to run a pilot program about the time of trout season. Again, it attracts a lot of anglers are just going to go out for a long weekend with the kids. So with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So you're saying that a pilot program would concentrate on a certain season of fish for effectiveness?
Well, I'm just saying, Madam Chair, I was just suggesting that a pilot program that's, you know, tied in conjunction with one of the major fisheries would probably be, you know, when you read about it a couple of times and it starts to sink in, and then you get a renewal notice in the mail, oh yeah, it just an additional trigger. And as you know, with any mailings, it helps to have a number of hits, and you can't always pay for all those hits. But if through earned media, through good marketing, you can bring about a lot of anglers into the fold.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Madam Chair, the fact that you said that there is a $1.50 surcharge, then the state possibly could have that as an admin mailing fee surcharge too. Would you see the retailers having a problem with still keeping the fee the same, but then having a surcharge so that when you order it through the mail, it would be the same price as having it in the stores?
Madam Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, are you suggesting that the $1.50 that the customer already pays would, instead of, you know, going to the retailer, would go to the department, that the department would collect on that surcharge?
Only those who would be renewing by mail. They wouldn't be coming in to get it. That possibly we could have the $1.50 added on when they renew it through by mail. It would be the same cost whether they go into you, because right now, from what I'm hearing, the stores add an extra $1.50.
That's correct.
And then everything but the $1.50 goes to the state. Is that correct?
That is
correct. And so if the state did it, they could add a $1.50 to what the fee would be. So it might be nice to do a fiscal impact on having that extra $1.50.
Madam Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, yeah, you could look at that. Because right now, if I understand correctly, you know, if you were to purchase, if an angler goes into regional office for Department of Fish and Wildlife and they purchase a license, you know, in fact, I think they're saving $1.50. There isn't any retailer.
It says on the fiscal sheet that the merchants keep one half of the fee, which is
75 cents.
Which is hardly enough if you have somebody standing there doing the work, is it?
That was sort of the response back, Madam Chair. That was sort of the response back. But nonetheless, it's also a service that, you know, they're very happy to provide. You know, the system is actually very efficient. You know, there were some early headaches. And, you know, occasionally, it can be very challenging for an employee to understand the controlled hunt system and process, process down, you know, different units and all that stuff. But nonetheless, it's an important service that they want to be able to offer to their customers. They'll help them get out there, have a safe, pleasurable experience.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee, that concludes the public hearing on House Bill 399. I'm closing that. We're not ready to go to work session because we're going to design a pilot program, and we will look forward to the presenters of this message coming back with an amendment. Okay, I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 3239. Have the staff read the description. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3239 prohibits correction or change to original plat recorded with the county clerk. Hey, Charles Stern, Yamhill County Clerk. Welcome. And did you have a good time in Washington, D.C.? Last time I talked to you, going back for election reform.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It was very informative, very interesting attending the NACO conference in Washington, D.C. This bill is a kind of a cleanup bill that it would look back at last session's, excuse me, House Bill 2774. Those of you who were around last year, you remember that the county surveyors, the public land surveyors, and the county clerks came and said, look, we'd like to make a change in how we deal with plats. We brought examples of plats that were deteriorating with age on Mylars, and we said, we want to microfilm these. But we can't microfilm these because the law requires that when interior monumentations are made, vacations of streets and roads, and various other annotations occur on the original plat. So we have to keep that constantly available to be updated by the county surveyor. So in 2774, we changed that to provide that you don't mark on the original plat, only on the county surveyor's copy, and then that allows us now to microfilm that original plat. They would continue to record the information that they always have recorded with us, that then we forward to the county surveyor to make the annotations with. That would continue so that the record remains constant of what the changes are to the plats. This, as we move after last session, we received some calls from both public land surveyors and county surveyors saying we didn't get all the statutes in that 2774. And so this bill, 3239, is picking up those additional statutes that were missed last session. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
No, I remember doing this last session. It was a good piece of work, and if we missed a couple things, I think it's appropriate that we do those technical fixes.
Representative Morgan.
I too remember this statute very well from the last session. So if we are proposing that the microfilm original copy of the plat will go into record, then how is it that we're going to get any updates or anything that's added after that point into the permanent record?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, the bill and the statute for a number of years has provided that whenever a public surveyor determines that there's a he needs to make some type of correction, or the law allows them to do a plat without doing the interior monumentation at the time, come back and add that, the statute has provided that they record an affidavit of the data. That would continue to be recorded. The only difference is right now for certain of those changes, the county surveyor then takes that data and starts to draw on that plat that was prepared by that public land surveyor and traces that on that. This would say, no, you don't do it on the original plat. You can do it on the county surveyor must do it on his copy, because when you record a plat, you record it, the original with the county clerk, a copy with the county surveyor, and in some cities also have a copy recorded with them. And so the one that gets updated would be the county surveyor's plat, his copy, not the original plat.
So if I was, I'm sorry, could I have a follow-up?
Go on.
If I was buying a piece of property and I went in and, I mean, how would I know that there were updates to the original plat?
Madam Chair.
Be aware of.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, when you do a search, a record search, the index would show all those relating. You'd have the plat, and then also tied to that would be all the affidavits of correction, affidavits of road vacations, affidavits of interior monumentation, whatever would apply if there were any, would be tied by index and reference. Now, how would you get to be able to see a picture of that? I think that is probably the bigger question that may be in your mind, is that you would, the county surveyor is required in the statute to maintain his copy, as he is now, with those, so you could go out and see the actual physical representation of the lines being drawn.
May I have one more question? There's another piece in here on page 3 of the bill, and it's in section 2 and it's subsection 6, and it changes the fee being able to collect, that you can collect for the recording of the affidavit. And what is being taken out is the ability of the county governing body to set the fee, and instead you're referencing a statute. Can you talk to us about what that's all about?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, yes. What that does, most of the fees for the clerk is set in ORS 205-320, and this is for just the recording of the affidavit. The plat, it's the cost of recording the plat is still set by the county governing body. The effort here was to make uniform across the state the recording of what the fees are for plats, for the, not plats, but for the affidavits. And it only applies to the affidavit, not the plat.
May I follow? Mm-hmm. Under the statute that's cited, who has the authority to set the level of the fee?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, you do. Now, in most of the fees in the clerk's office, including the cost of a copy of a record of a county clerk, is set by the legislature. It's not set. And there's one of the reasons behind that is the extensive across-county recording activity by in the area of land records. You know, it's a bank in Central Oregon may record something in the valley or some other county. And so you're going across all these county lines, and I think an interest that the title industry and the banking industry had was to create as uniform as possible fees for land records.
I have one more follow-up. My recollection from when we dealt with issues in the last session was that There was not unanimity within your professional association about how to deal with things, and I was wondering if let me back up here. You're a county clerk?
That's correct.
Oh, okay. That within the survey community there was not anonymity or not unanimous. They weren't unanimous in how they felt about the changes, and that there was quite a pronounced division between the urban surveyors and the rural surveyors on a number of issues. And what I'm curious about is what those people feel about this. But as a county clerk, you probably have no basis to answer them.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I called the county surveyors to remind them that this bill was up. I did not talk to public land surveyors. I intended to, and then it just slipped off my horizon. But this part of what was changed last session,
I don't remember a lot of disparaging views. It is true that there are some counties that will not be microfilming. The number of plats that is received by Wheeler County a year, you know, they're not going to spend the money to film those probably. There's so few. But what it does is gives the opportunity. So if the clerk continues to want to maintain as the official record a piece of Mylar, they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But where you are having lots of development activity, a lot of plats being filed and recorded, it gives the opportunity now to film those and preserve them for long-term storage.
And I can, I'm sorry,
if I
can see, I mean, the changes that this would put in place would facilitate things in where you have a large volume to deal with. And I think that there are reasonable requests in here. I would want to hear, Madam Chair, from the areas of the state where the volume is not an issue, just to make sure that this isn't going to cause any unforeseen problems or have some ramifications that may not be apparent to us right now.
Representative Morgan, that's a good point. What I generally do is call my clerk or call my government official on bills that I see go by that will affect them, and I would encourage all of you to call your areas on this to make sure they're okay with it. But the fact that they are not here indicates that perhaps they're not concerned. Representative Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morgan kind of reminded me, and as I remember, the debate was between county surveyors and private surveyors, but I also had a sense that at the end of the day, everybody was pretty much on board. Am I remembering that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, there was another bill that was somewhat contentious between county surveyors and the public land and private land surveyors in dealing with the surveyor's review of the surveyor's work. That was a separate bill. This bill, I don't remember any major discussion between the private and public. There was some discussion initially on, well, what will this do? How will this work? By the county surveyors amongst themselves, but I don't remember the private versus public debate on this topic. There was another topic there was significant amount of debate on, and that was the review by county surveyors of the public land surveyors' work.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might, without this bill, what it does, it leaves some affidavits which cannot be marked on the plat, original plat, and some which can. And so kind of without this bill, it kind of leaves us in that no man's land, and so that was kind of this was brought to us by surveyors saying we missed stuff last session, and so it kind of leaves us in that no man's land right now.
Okay, further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3239. I'm going to open a work session on this bill. Okay, I think it's pretty clear cut what they're trying to do here. We have discussion.
Madam Chair, I am not comfortable with voting this out of the committee this time because I feel the need very strongly to check with the surveyors and in my area to make sure that this isn't going to have any unintended consequences. And I tried to do that, but with daylight savings,
right.
It just didn't work.
Representative
Cruz.
Yeah, well, for Representative Morgan, I guess my sense is if Romy had a problem with this, we'd heard by now. Because Romy's never been shy, at least communicating with me about bills that he thought were problematic for his shop. But
further discussion. Representative Hatt.
Madam Chair, I think maybe we should survey the situation.
so to speak.
Did you say what has not come up with that?
I will move this bill then to Friday, but I would like to move it. So I would like you to all make your phone calls in on Friday if you could. And we'll bring it back. And Charles isn't too far away, so I hope it isn't a burden for you to come back if you choose to Friday. Is that acceptable? Okay. Okay, I'm going to close the work session then on 3239.
Right.
And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2978. And we have amendments committee that are being duplicated as I speak. We'll be here shortly. John Chandler. Representative Cruz, could you walk outside the hall and see if John is out in the hall and could come in and say something? Do his thing here. Okay. I'll read the description. Prohibit local government or special district from adopting public facilities strategy unless justified by written findings and public hearing. Specifies what findings must demonstrate, limits effective period of public facilities strategy to 24 months.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Land Use Specialist for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2978. You should also have been given copies of the proposed Dash 1 amendment. Do we have copies of the Dash 1 amendment?
It's coming. We're duplicating it.
Very good. I'll just tell you, while we're waiting for those to come in, I'll tell you a little bit about the bill, the background of it, and what the Dash 1s do in advance of their arrival. The public facility strategy were put into Oregon law in, I believe, 1995, essentially in response to a situation occurring in the city of Wilsonville. And what was happening in Wilsonville at that time was a great deal of growth and development. They were running out of water capacity. They were running out of road capacity. Any of you who have traveled I-5 know that oftentimes there's bottlenecks at I-5 Wilsonville Road. Under the law at that time, a city had two choices. They could continue issuing development permits, just like business as usual, or they could stop issuing them altogether, because the moratorium statute, which is not in front of you, says that a moratorium is defined as any slowing down or stopping of issuance of permits. So if a jurisdiction tried to slow things down, technically they were in a moratorium and had to declare a moratorium and hit the stop button. What we did in 95 was try to come up with what we call a public facility strategy, which is not a particularly elegant name, but a way of for jurisdictions to have an option open to them other than simply stopping or going full tilt, a way of rationing permits, if you will, of setting up a process by which they could continue allowing economic development to occur. In the Wilsonville example, the city of Wilsonville absolutely did not want to declare a moratorium because they felt that would send a bad signal to business and industry that was looking to locate there, and we certainly did not want them to declare a moratorium either. We wanted to figure out some way out of the box. That was the genesis of the bill. What House Bill 2978 does is add some procedural protections to the public facility strategy. I mentioned the moratorium statute, and in the moratorium statute, there's a series of things that local government has to do. They have to adopt findings. They have to make very clear about it's the impact of the moratorium on housing and economic development, so on and so forth. We're trying to base the language in front of you is basically borrowed from the moratorium statute, so the public facility strategies track more closely with how the moratorium operates. So in terms of procedural protection, when a jurisdiction adopts them, we added in the amendments here add language saying that they have to demonstrate that there was something happened they didn't anticipate. They're trying to keep it to a specific geographic area, the impact of it, that is structured in a way so that housing, commercial, industrial development can occur, will not be unreasonably restricted, and then have a clear and objective description of what they intend to do to fix the problem. The Dash 1 amendments make a couple of changes that are significant. Essentially, well, the first change is on page 2 of the bill. Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'll just walk through the amendments very quickly. On line 7 on page 2, the word performed has been changed to adopted, which is a more precise reference to the adoption of the plan. And then we added language starting on page 19 of the bill after where it says that a public facility strategy can't be effective for more than 24 months. We added language allowing a three extensions of up to 1 year each, so the jurisdiction faced with a infrastructure problem would have up to 5 years to fix it. The intent behind the bill and the amendment is to give jurisdictions choices. If they're faced with a situation that they're running out of a public facility that's necessary for development to occur, they can either declare a moratorium, which may be the option in some cases, or use a public facility strategy, and then with these amendments, it does require them to have some additional procedural steps, but also allows a definite time frame that's fairly, I think, geared towards actually giving them time to fix the problem, get the water system fixed, put the road in, whatever it might be. We've shared these amendments with local government. I know the city of Wilsonville has signed up to testify. I know at least one of the issues they're going to raise, and it's one that I'll mention to the committee briefly. Their concern is that there ought to be some language in the bill to allow for natural disasters. Right now, the way it's worded, it's additional development occurring that they hadn't anticipated. There is an argument that said, but what if there's an earthquake or a flood or something else that occurs that wasn't anticipated? As I've told Wilsonville, I'm certainly open to that idea. My concern is I do want to try to keep the public facility strategy and the moratorium law fairly parallel, and I'm not sure that we can do that if we add that language in this bill, because the relating clause is so narrow we couldn't also add it to the moratorium statute. But I'm by no means closing that out. That was an idea that came through the email last week. It was from the Wilsonville city attorney. He and I haven't finished our conversation on it. I would like, assuming the committee is okay with this, and we'll see what the other testimony is, my preference would be to go ahead and move the bill, continue conversations, and if we decide that we do need to do that, it's a fairly easy amendment to make in the Senate. But I realize this committee is likely to get backed up on time. Anyhow, that's the bill. As in terms of sex and violence, it's not particularly stimulating one, but it, I think, is a necessary one. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Representative Lee. Thank you, Madam Chair. John, were these amendments worked out with Burton Weist and the Special Districts folks as well?
Thank you, Chair Close, Representative Lee. I sent these specifically to Mr. Weist and asked him, the reference in the front of the bill to Special Districts and putting them through periodic review and whatnot, that was Legislative Council's idea at how to pull this into the moratorium statute. I don't speak special district. Mr. Weiss tells me they're fine with those amendments.
Thank you.
Question, Representative Forey.
Thank you. Can you tell us what occasion brought this bill to be needed, right? I mean, why do we need this bill right now? Is there something that's happened that just brought this forward?
No, nothing is happening. To the best of my knowledge, there's only been two public facility strategies done. One is Wilsonville, and the other is a town starting with S. I'm not sure which town starting with S it is. I was trying to remember that this morning. I haven't filed. It might be Staten. We're pretty sure it's not Springfield. It's probably not Shanico. But there's only been the two. What?
Sherwood.
Sherwood? Sweden. No, it's not Sweden. That's not a town.
That's okay.
I'm getting help from the audience here. You need to call a lifeline. Do I win any money if I get it right? That's the other question. Basically, what prompted this was noticing, and nothing, I don't recall, frankly, what stimulated it, that the original bill, when we passed it in 95, didn't have a lot of procedural protection in it. And so we wanted before, and I'm frankly surprised more jurisdictions haven't used this tool because I think it's a good one for them. I'm glad they have it because the original bill was a little open-ended as to how it got implemented. So we're not trying to stop anything. I'm not aware of anything happening right now that we're trying to get ahead of, but I think it's a good set of protections for when jurisdictions do use it.
John, can you kind of walk us through a scenario? When the city of Wilsonville did this with this public facility strategy, what did it look like? What were the major elements of it, and what were they trying to address exactly?
Madam Chair, the Wilsonville has the mayor here, I believe. If you'd like, she can respond to that certainly better than I can. And I frankly don't recall if it was water or or roads that was the subject of it, or both. But they had a couple problems facing them that were very difficult ones. And at the time when we did the bill, the intent was to try to keep, because Wilsonville, like I said, did not want to declare a moratorium, wanted to keep them in a position where they could continue issuing permits. But because of their infrastructure problems, they really had no choice but to start to slow things down, which then triggered the moratorium statute the way it was written. It was they were caught in a box, and to their credit, from my standpoint, obviously, it was that they did not want to declare a moratorium was a good thing. So we were trying to walk through. And the scenario that this would be intended to address would be that situation where a jurisdiction has a water problem, let's say, knows how to fix it, intends to put in another storage tank or a well or whatever, needs time to do that, bring it online, and doesn't want to hit the stop button. They can go forward and with some kind of a permit rationing to keep the issuance of development permits and the economic development of the community going while they're bringing their system online. It's just another tool in the kit, as it were.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
We'll call the mayor of Wilsonville next.
And Charlotte, is it Lehan?
Lehan.
Lehan. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I distributed my testimony there, and I won't bother to read it. We have been working with Mr. Chandler to come up with the amendments that you have before you, and we're in agreement on those. I think that gives a reasonable time period because a lot of these infrastructure issues and deficiencies are very complex and involve multi-millions of dollars in terms of getting the public around a solution. So they can't be done overnight. Just saying it so doesn't make it so. Our concern is with, of course, maybe I should back up. The purpose, of course, of a public facility strategy is to allow development to go forward when you have significant deficiencies without declaring a moratorium. And specifically how we've used it with regards to water, and we're in a public facility strategy right now, we ended up really in trouble on water from two directions. One was tremendous growth, been for many years one of the fastest growing cities in Oregon. And the other side was a more rapid than anticipated decline in our groundwater. And so we were hit by from both sides with a diminishing infrastructure issue there, resource. And the public facility strategy allowed us to say what we did was we put development into three categories, one being a de minimis, where you could go forward with your project if it was a minor amount of water or no water required. For instance, the school project could go forward and they went forward with the restriction that they couldn't do anything in their building on the summer until our new water came online. And everyone who went forward with development had to sign up for low landscaping and put off some of their landscaping requirements until the new water came online. We had a second category that was that allowed development to proceed if you weren't taking occupancy until after October of 2001. So larger projects could proceed that weren't, and we have underway. InFocus is underway with a very large project, but they won't take occupancy until after the new water's online. And then the third category was putting people in a queue, where we had determined what exactly, you know, down to the last gallon of water we had in terms of capacity, so the rest of development then was in that queue, and they've jostled around and you know, changed positions depending on their situation, but it's tailored to the individual deficiency and the individual community, and to a large degree was tailored to our developers and what projects needed to go forward and how we could work that out, short of the huge hammer of a moratorium. And of course, with something like water, it's a significant public health and safety issue because we have to maintain our fire flows, and we can't let it get down below a level where we don't have the pressures that we need. So that that's how it works for Wilsonville. Our concern with it, and we added some suggested language, as Mr. Chandler said, we've been in discussions with him about this, but when you have an unexpected or unanticipated mismatch between growth and your infrastructure, there are two sides to that equation, and this still only allows for one, which is unanticipated growth. And the point we're making is that you might also have unanticipated deficiency or failure, whether that was a natural disaster or, in our case, the groundwater started dropping much faster than anyone predicted. You know, something else could happen on the other side of the equation that would leave you short and unable to meet the needs of development. So we're trying to recognize that either side might throw you off a balance and put you in a situation where you wanted to allow development to go forward, but needed to control the rate or control the type or the whatever in order to not have that that resource or infrastructure run out sooner than anticipated. That's our concern with the bill is only that and with that, I think the public facility strategy has worked very well for us. I don't know why more places don't use it, but it's been effective for us to keep us out of a moratorium situation.
Can you tell us, I guess we could pull the statute, but can you tell us, with the moratorium, how does it read? I mean, if there is like an earthquake and there's massive destruction, does the moratorium, then are you required to, what are you required to do? And is there a time period?
I don't really know. I'm presuming if you had a massive sort of disaster that you declare an emergency and kind of all bets are off. What we're more concerned about is more the not quite the catastrophic level of something where you might have some failure in one part of town that doesn't affect the other part of town, or that you'd want to be able to develop some strategy around. Dealing with, and I have to admit I'm not that familiar with how it's addressed in the moratorium statute. I know once you go into a full-out emergency, declare an emergency, then I think these things are kind of by the board.
So you're required to not allow any building, is that true, until, you know, trying to envision this.
Right.
Rubble is cleared.
Well, the situation would be if you had a big failure in, say, in a critical transportation link, an overpass, an underpass, or something is not functioning, or some part of your infrastructure for delivery, for instance, could fail in terms of water delivery or sewer or something, that you'd say, this is going to take more than 6 months to fix. If your water treatment plant or your sewage treatment plant or something had an issue, but the point being that it might not affect all areas of the city equally, and you'd want to be able to go forward in other areas, and that it might not be the level of disaster that would cause a full-out emergency declaration or moratorium.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on this bill? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2978, and I'm going to open the work session on 2978. Committee, we have one amendment, and that puts the time period on a single extension. It changes the word, it adds the word adopted on line 7 on page 2 to perform. Is there a discussion on the dash 1? Representative Morgan.
Is there a motion to move the dash 1 to the bill?
I believe we can do that. I don't have a problem with the dash 1s.
I make a motion that we move the dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2978.
Representative Morgan has moved the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 2978. Is there discussion?
Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. I guess the next thing we need to decide is if we want to deal with the natural disasters amendment that the city of Wilsonville has talked about or not. What is the feeling of the committee?
Move the bill.
Move the bill? Is that a motion?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2978 as amended to the full to do pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz has moved House Bill 2978 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I think this is something the Senate may want to consider. And of course, you're perfectly able to do that. So, further discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Excused.
Representative
Aye. Representative King? Is
excused.
Representative Cruz? Aye. Representative Lee? Aye. Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Chair Quillip? Both aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2978 moves to the House floor. Representative Kefouri, would you like to carry this bill? Is that possible with your strenuous schedule?
It is. It's Representative Morgan's bill if she wanted to.
It would be fine as soon as you would do that.
Okay. I will be more than happy to.
Okay. For the good of the committee. Seeing none, we are adjourned.